Those of us who eat meat occasionally or often wrestle with our consciences once in a while. The food we eat to live involves the death of another animal. Today's guest is acutely aware of that. Miles Olson hunts for food, one of the many ways in which he lives off the land. No factory-farmed animals for him. Miles Olson is the author of a book released last month from New Society Publishers. It is called The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook, Hunting from the Heart, and it delves into both hunting philosophy and practice, both in rich detail. Miles Olson, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a bit about how you come to this issue. You apparently live very much off the land.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a fairly typical suburban situation in Canada on the west coast here on Vancouver Island. And I actually became a vegetarian when I was 12 years old because I guess I saw a couple of those videos that PETA puts out about, showing factory farming conditions and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I was in my late teens, I decided that I wanted to live off the land. And I spent basically a decade living in cabins that I built off the grid in the backwoods. And very quickly, I realized that if I wanted to eat any significant amount of my diet from the earth itself in this climate, it was going to necessitate killing. And so I came to hunting kind of a roundabout way, almost begrudgingly.
It sounds like if you're a vegetarian at 12, sure. What, were you just trying to repudiate the suburban lifestyle or something?
I just felt that there was something more than the kind of status quo that everyone accepts and lives in, the high-tech, modern, fast-paced world. I wanted to get out, kind of like Thoreau, right? He said, I went to the woods to live rich and suck the marrow out of life, and not when I came to die, find out that I hadn't lived. So that was the same. You know, kind of the universal impulse to go to nature to find truth.
You're going to call this the Ethical Hunter's Guidebook, Miles. Why change?
Because ethics are products of the mind, right? Like, ethics are intellectual, rational decisions and constructs that we make about reality and how we interact with the world. And I felt that the way that I approach hunting and killing for food is a kind of a conscious decision. I don't have to do it, so it's informed by my beliefs and all of that. But at the same time, when you actually, even if you're informed intellectually as to why you want to kill a deer for your food, when you actually do that, when you actually take a life, all of a sudden there's a gravity to the situation that is far, far beyond intellectual understanding. So I wanted to touch into that, which is, that's really the marrow of the process of hunting. That's really the most deep, fascinating, humbling, and profound part of it.
We should get the disclaimers out of the way early. This is not a book for the squeamish, right?
No, I don't think so. there's no graphic pictures or anything, but yeah, it's talking about killing, right? It's very bluntly.
Killing and butchering, too. I mean, you talk about how to field dress a deer and gut it and everything. And so, there are some pictures and descriptions in there that if people haven't been exposed to this before, they might say, really? That's something I hadn't seen.
Yeah, perhaps even more than the average hunting book, because a big emphasis is on using the whole creature, right? So there's instructions on how to use skins and hooves and testicles and all of this, which even the average hunter would be pretty squeamish about.
Well, and it should go without saying, but we'll go ahead and say it anyway. This is not about trophy hunting. This is not about putting heads on the wall. This is absolutely about food.
Yeah, my approach to hunting is purely subsistence. So it's about food. Yeah, and it's about the deeper layers of that interaction as well.
And Miles, you begin the book with a story of shooting a deer. I mean, and you talk about the beauty of the animal, but you take him down and you hug the animal you killed.
Yeah.
What was that about?
It's not something that I do or have done every time that I've hunted a deer or any other animal, but it's, I guess it, whenever that's happened, it's just an impulse that takes me over, and it's just this enormous sense of gratitude. I don't know, have you ever hunted?
No, I haven't.
So I don't know if I could explain it to someone who hasn't experienced it in a way that really captures the essence of it, but every time that I've taken the life of an animal, and in this case it was a deer, so I took the life of this deer, and then when I came upon it and saw its calm body and looked at its face, just the feeling of gratitude that washed over me was so intense, so powerful, and I guess that's what motivated me to hug it. It was just like, I am so filled with gratitude right now. And it's just an interesting paradox, because I wasn't, in another sense, it's a moment of loss, right? It's a moment where I'm acutely aware that I've taken this life, and I know that it was a really beautiful, you know, I'm totally awakened to the fact that it's beautiful and that I've taken that beauty out of the world. But the feeling of gratitude is just overwhelming. So there's this interesting paradox that's just what hunting is.
We'll explore that much further with Miles Olson. His book is The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook, Hunting from the Heart, just out from New Society Publishers. We'll come back and talk more with Miles, and you can join us at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Miles Olson and The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook, and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Miles Olson. He is a hunter himself and the author of a book about hunting, both on philosophy and practice. It's called The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook, Hunting from the Heart. Miles Olson lives off the land, and this is all about food and not about trophies or mounting things on the wall. He tries to use as much of the animal as is possible. Join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about philosophy and practice in hunting and compassion as well. 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. This first vignette in the book about you taking out this deer is a really powerful one in a lot of ways, but I'm just curious about how much conscious thought goes into it anymore about the fact that there's this big, beautiful animal, and yet you killed them. I mean, you needed them for food.
Yeah. So what's interesting about it is that that's a process that's made graphic and apparent to someone who's doing it themselves. And yet it's implied in our existence as creatures automatically, you know, like all of us take our life has a cost, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the environment. And so in a broad sense, everyone has got the same accountability as the hunter. But the hunter has the direct experience of it and the direct awareness of it. Even if you don't kill animals to eat, I mean, if you're a vegetarian or vegan, you know, a combine harvester that harvests grain, for instance, still takes out, you know, countless rodents and snakes and all that. It kills them as a byproduct of the harvest. And, so I feel like no matter what you eat, there's actually an associated cost of life that just kind of as a great equalizer. Because I think a lot of people think, why would you hunt? Why? You don't need to do that. There's no need. We live in a modern world.
But the point is that in a modern world, though, and this is a great trade-off to point out here, is that there's killing the animal yourself versus industrial farming. And there's a very, very different quality of life for an animal that's going to spend their lives on a concentrated animal feeding operation.
Oh, geez. It's not even comparable. You know, you've got complete freedom from birth to death. The only moment at which their life is disrupted is the moment that the hunter kills, versus the animal in a feedlot, which is basically a concentration camp, you know? It's pretty grim with that reality that we create and that we perpetuate. So, the two things I don't feel are comparable, really, on an ethical level. But, getting back to your question, you know, how do I square that off, that feeling of taking the life of something beautiful? There's all the things that I just listed, again, are kind of intellectual or ethical arguments. You know, like if you look at it, there's an associated cost of life with everything. Even in the modern world, there's still that death. We're just hidden from it. But at a deep personal level, for me, it always feels humbling, but it always actually feels quite right. As long as I'm capable of doing the whole process in a humane way and using as much of the body as I can. But there's this deep feeling that it's almost like a very kind of primal, intuitive or ancestral feeling that just feels right when I'm out there.
You hear the argument, you're quite aware of it in the book, that hunters are gun-toting rednecks. What's your view about that?
Well, my view is that there's a whole spectrum of what a hunter is and what a hunter can be, right? And there's a stereotype that hunters just want to, you know, they're kind of over-aggressive, overstimulated jocks that just want to blow the heads off things for fun. And there's actually some people who are like that. So there is a place on the spectrum of hunters where those guys go, or guys and girls, whoever. And then there's this whole other range of what that act can be. And on the other opposite end of it, there's what hunting has been for millennia for indigenous people and for, you know, people living off the land. And that's just it's a matter of subsistence. And a matter of deep respect for the creatures that one harvests, because when you actually rely on something for your subsistence, it gives you a really profound reverence for it. You know, when you have to haul water, for instance, I remember once I was living in the woods for a summer and I had to haul water every morning, get up at 6 in the morning before the sun got too high and it got too hot, haul water for a few hours to the garden, haul water for drinking and cooking and washing, from this little creek, and man, by the end of that summer, did I ever have a deeper appreciation and understanding and relationship to water. It's the same with hunting. When you actually are reliant on something and enter into that relationship with it, you got a really different kind of reverence for it.
Miles Olson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook. Here's Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Well, I really resonate with what you're saying. I was raised in a family of hunters, and I always think, you know, if an animal's allowed to live a free life with its natural conditions in the wild, that's far superior to the concentrated animal feeding operations, or even people who are humanely raising cows in small family farms. They're still fenced in. They're still not really free. And I watched a film that, you know, I'd already known all this stuff, and it kind of re-reminded me, and it was done so well. It was called Earthlings, and Joaquin Phoenix was the narrator, and it just goes comprehensively through vivisection, animal testing, puppy mills. And one of the things that it brought up that I had kind of forgotten was leather production and tanneries. And so what I'm looking for is when I go purchase products, which I try not to do very often because good to not consume so much, and a lot of the stuff I get, leather, is from St. Vinny's or Goodwill or whatever, look for humanely treated labels, and I don't know if they even have it for leather, but in the film Earthlings, they showed in India, where the cow is sacred, they can't kill the cow, so they basically, I mean, it's just so sad, they basically starve it, and they make it walk until it just collapses and dies, so it's the opposite of what they revere the cow for. And I just want to commend you, because I think that people need to really think about where they get their animal products, how it's produced, how the animals are treated, because I think we have a responsibility, a moral and ethic responsibility, to take care of the earth and all its creatures and be conscious. And, you know, my thing with people, I say, you know, buy a quality product. I work at a farmer's market. I'm the manager, and the meat we get is all humanely treated in small farms. You know, buy less of it, pay more, but eat less, and it's healthier for you as well. So those are my comments, and thanks again for what you're doing. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks for calling, Pam. Appreciate it. Your thoughts, Miles?
Oh, thanks for your comments. And just the thoughts on the leather, because you mentioned leather and wanting to try and find ethical leather. And I've done a lot of tanning of hides, naturally, of course, without chemicals. But the industrially produced leather is one of the most toxic industries that there is, I think. It's the chromes and all the different toxic chemicals that they use are extremely, extremely toxic. And they've never been able to industrialize natural tanning. It's only possible to do it on a backyard home scale. So if you want to find naturally tanned leather, you have to find somebody who does it themselves by hand, basically. And they're out there. There's lots of them.
We're talking to Miles Olson about his book, The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook, Hunting from the Heart. This is about using every part of the animal and cutting out the middle person so there's no concentrated animal feeding operations in the food chain for our guest today. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Chris in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Miles Olson.
Hi, thank you for your message. I raise homestead animals, well, specifically ducks, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on slaughtering domesticated animals.
All right, good point to bring up. Thanks for that, Chris. Miles?
My thoughts on slaughtering domesticated animals. Well, I've done some of that. I had chickens once, but they were kind of feral chickens, to be honest. They didn't have a penned in area. My thoughts, that's a really interesting question.
Well, let me frame it up as a middle ground, because there is a place somewhere between hunting animals that are completely wild and having animals grown essentially like plants in a real confined environment at the concentrated animal feeding operations. What about the grass-fed beef that's out there on...
I mean, basically, that relationship is kind of what I'm talking about philosophically, just coming into contact with that death, which it's actually a process of transformation, because when you kill an animal and you take it, like the difference, I always talk about the difference between hunting and killing. And if we're going to include domesticated animals here, then I'll call the difference between harvesting and killing. And the difference is, when you kill something, you just kill it and then it's dead. And when you harvest something, you take it into your body. And that's an alchemical process, right? All of a sudden, you and that body become one. And whatever had illuminated the body beforehand is gone, but you incorporate it into yourself, you know? And that's a really profound process. So that's when someone's raising their own ducks or chickens or cows and doing it themselves, then they're stepping out of this kind of disconnected, alienated reality we've all been raised in, largely in North America, and stepping back into that profound connection.
Where we are aware of not just what we eat, but essentially who we eat.
Yeah, who we eat, and just that whole cycle, the wheel of life and death that we're all on.
Let us take another call. Here's Mark in McKinleyville, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Miles Olson.
Hey, I just wanted to throw in that I'm a hunter of my whole adult life, and the ethical bearing that I have gotten through hunting is that I really feel uncomfortable buying food, meat, like at a major grocery outlet or something like that, just because of the ethical dilemma of how those animals are treated and raised, and the hunting really is... seems an ethically superior position to be in, just because you've taken responsibility, you know, what's happened to the animal. And I've also raised my kids, they've hunted, and their respect for the animals and the outdoors and their awareness of tides and weather and everything around having to be in the field and harvest is so much greater than their peers. It's been a pretty amazing informing process for myself and my family.
I'm curious about the reaction that that your kids get from schoolmates, things like that. You know, whether they think they're barbarians or something because they do hunt, or whether they're fascinated by it and would like to do it themselves.
Most of them are pretty fascinated by it. We're in a pretty rural area here, and hunting is probably more acceptable than in other regions, urban areas, I think. But generally, people are fascinated by it, and we feed people a lot because it's really satisfying to see people, eat a duck or a goose or something that we've harvested, and just the revelation of how much care we have, and when we cook it, present it, talk about it, how it's harvested, how the conditions that made it possible for us to get it, all the challenge and extremely hard work it takes to get meat on the table like that. But they're readily accepted by their peers.
All right, thanks for the story there, Mark. Appreciate that. So, Miles, you point out that is a lot of hard work to get meat this way.
Oh, I mean, it's not. It's just a whole other dimension than going to the grocery store and buying it, right? It's just a whole other dimension to I never try to compare the two or try and quantify it like that. But yeah, I totally agree. He's right. It's a lot of work, and there's just so much care and appreciation tied into it.
There's a riff in the Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook about catch and release fishing, and it seems to trouble you, or did at one time. Why?
Well, I don't have any judgment against the people that do it so much, but it just confuses me. So the catch and release fishing is, sport fishing, where you hook a fish, reel it in, and hopefully keep it on the line. The line doesn't break or the fish doesn't get off the hook, and then you get it in, and once you've landed the fish, you throw it back. And to me, it actually just, it seems crazy. I don't have softer words to use for it, because the fish is alive. It's feeling, you know what I mean? And to put it through all that pain and struggle just for entertainment, really, I don't see any other purpose behind it. To me, there's just a gap there as far as empathy, and empathy meaning, of course, to be able to feel, to sense another's feelings and to respond to another's feelings. You know, I think it's really important that we have empathy for non-humans, if they're fish or mammals or whatever. And to me, that's just a graphic illustration of how we can really be shut off from the feelings of non-humans. And it's not like factory farming. It's not that insane, but it still just puzzles me. And I know that there's a lot of sports fishermen who do catch and release. They're good people, really appreciate nature, love the outdoors. So no condemnation. It just, I feel that there is a lack of empathy in that.
Doesn't work for your ethical construct. The process, learning the skills of hunting, first of all, was it 5 years you were a vegetarian?
I was vegetarian off and on for probably starting when I was 12 and ending in my late teens. So yeah, let's say 5-ish years.
All right. So and had you learned your hunting skills before that age? I'm trying to figure out when you first learned how to.
I started learning basically once I had already been moved into the woods after I dropped out of high school and moved into the woods and started learning wild edibles and all of that at 17 is when I started. So
Miles, when did you, how much did you struggle with the first time you shot an animal for food?
The first time was pretty intense, but I had been working myself up to it in a lot of different ways. I had fished for many years and I had picked up roadkill on many occasions to kind of acquaint myself with how to gut an animal and skin it and all of that. These are good little baby steps towards it. So, but there's nothing that really can fully prepare you for what that feels like to you know, step into taking a life.
And is there still a moment even now when you pull the trigger, before you pull the trigger, when you just sort of have to gather yourself?
Yeah, somewhat, yeah. There's a lot of adrenaline, like it's a complex mix of emotions and adrenaline and all of that when that moment comes. But yeah, it is. It always has a lot of gravity.
All kinds of things going on in body, mind, and heart at the moment of pulling the trigger. Miles Olson's book is The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook, Hunting from the Heart. We'll come back and talk more with Miles and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Miles Olson. He is a hunter and an author. His book is The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook, Hunting from the Heart, in which he talks about going from being a vegetarian to being a hunter and making sure that when he takes an animal, he takes it for food and uses every part of the animal that it is possible to use. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. There's a rich discussion in both philosophy and process here. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. The story of Christopher McCandless is relayed in your book, The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook. Who was he, and why is his story important to note?
Christopher McCandless was an American traveler and adventurer and vagrant during the 1990s, and he hitchhiked over several years. He grew up in a wealthy family on the East Coast. And decided one day as a university student to leave his family, run away and change his name and disappear and become a homeless traveler. And he found his way over a couple of years of traveling up to Alaska, and he bought a rifle, and he actually hitchhiked through Canada and into Alaska with a rifle slung over his shoulder, which is amazing, because I guess that is a commentary on, I guess, the old 90s and how relaxed things were then. And, yeah, so he got dropped off and hiked up this trail that he had a little map of and ended up trying to hunt and gather for his livelihood for several months, and he had a stack of rice and stuff. But he did a lot of small game hunting, and he kept a record of it. He shot lots of squirrels and ptarmigan and different animals, and eventually he shot a moose, cow moose, and his buddies down that he had worked with in the southern states had told him how to preserve meat in the bush. So when he shot these small animals like rabbits and stuff, it's just a one-meal animal, he shot a moose, and he had hundreds of pounds of meat to deal with ASAP because it was June and it was hot out. And he had been told that you hang the meat in big chunks and smoke it, kind of like hams, and that's how you preserve it. So he built a makeshift smoker and started hanging these big hams. And of course, that's not how you preserve meat, by drying. You know, if you want to preserve meat in the bush without refrigeration or a freezer, then you basically want to slice it as thin as you can and hang it to dry like clothes on a clothesline. So what happened was the meat eventually all got engulfed with maggots, and he, you know, was completely terrified that he had killed a moose and failed to preserve its meat, and basically all of it spoiled except for what he could eat immediately, which is not much considering the size of a moose. And so all the meat spoiled, and he wrote about it in his journal. And basically, at the end of the summer, he never came out of the woods. He ended up starving. And it was a really tragic story, incredibly tragic, and it was kind of memorialized in the book Into the Wild and in the movie Into the Wild. So he's kind of a countercultural figure now, mm-hmm. kind of a martyr. And I relate his story in the book because, well, it's a somewhat famous story of hunting going wrong and the tragedy of killing an animal and not being able to make use of its body. And I guess to me, what's tragic about it is that A, he didn't make it out of the woods. And then, but excluding that, because he felt like the killing the moose was the worst mistake he ever made in his life. That's what he wrote in his journal. And the reason is because he failed to complete the cycle that I described earlier. You know, the difference between killing something and harvesting something is that you're able to make use. You take it into your body if you harvest it. That's what the difference is. And so he wasn't able to fulfill the cycle. He wasn't able to honor the body by eating it and preserving it. If he had been able to, he probably would have stumbled back into town at the end of the summer and said that it was the best thing he had ever done.
And instead, it was the worst moment of his life, and his life didn't last long beyond that. One of the interesting things about that, though, is your analysis of it, and you talk about the amount of energy he was expending. He had to work really, really hard to try to make use of this moose, and ultimately failed at it. But it's really an interesting look at the way you look at nature and hunting itself, and how much time and effort you're going to have to spend to get food out of it, which obviously you feel is very much worth it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, I don't even think of it as work when you're doing it. You know, it's just, I guess, something instinctive just kicks in and you just do it. And it feels good. It feels, it's connection. It's quite beautiful. And there's a deep, deep satisfaction that comes along with it. So, yeah, when people say, oh, it's so much work, see, work is something that you do when you don't want to do it, you know?
Right.
Like, did Beethoven think of it as work when he was writing brilliant pieces of music, or did Picasso think of it as work when he was painting a picture? I'm not comparing hunting to that, but in a sense, I guess I am, because when you're actually passionate about what you're doing and it feeds you at a deep level, then it doesn't feel like work. I mean, it can be exhausting. There's been times when I've almost, you know, just being sleep deprived and it's, you know, it's below freezing out and my hands are getting numb, but I have to finish skinning this deer or something. But it never feels like work. It feels more like just like life.
Let us get another call in here. Here's Julie in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Miles Olson, the author of The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook.
Hi. Thank you so much for this book. It took a lot of courage for me to listen to it because I wanted to say thank you for being so compassionate and full of gratitude and reminding us that that's something that we're a little bit once removed from. You know, when you were talking about bullets and the show before was about the condor and eating lead fragments from ammunition and, you know, the impact that we do have on other life on this planet is pretty big. And I just wanted to talk about, you know, even people driving their cars and hitting deer is like a bullet of sorts. And I recently did that, so I'm in touch with it. And the deer didn't die, but it did hurt its leg, and I have no idea what happened to it. I don't have a gun, and I couldn't take it out of its misery. So anyway, there's that unknown factor. And what I want to address that I think your book addresses is that, you know, we really do have a lot of feelings and we really do care about these things, but we're so conditioned to burying it all and just going on with life because, you know, we're busy, busy, busy. And I went up to the place where I hit the deer yesterday and I tried to find it. Try to find where it was and re-experience, you know, some of these feelings that I'm still having. And I would like to just mention how hard it was for me to remain conscious and present and in the now moment while I was driving, looking for this spot. And then it was the time of day when the deer were coming out, and to be really conscious to see the deer and drive with the awareness not to hit them. And it just took a lot to keep my mind focused. And I just want to mention that I have become so distracted from those feelings and that awareness. So I thank you for stepping forward with all the compassion and gratitude that you have in putting this book out.
All right. Thanks for the call, Julie. Appreciate it. Miles, that's a big compliment.
Yeah, thanks a lot. That's
the point that she brings up, though, is really interesting, because it sort of dovetails into what you do, more than sort of, in the sense that you're talking about an absolute awareness of what goes on with the animals. This is something that Julie got sort of the hard way. By hitting an animal with her car, but this is something you advocate in the book, is to know the behavior of the animals that you are tracking.
Yeah, and I mean, that's part and parcel of the act. But what that experience of hitting a deer with your car is just, you know, breaking us out of our day-to-day existence that enables us to be separated from that awareness and those feelings and that connection. So yeah, to me, that's another thing that hunting facilitates, is just breaking one out of the haze and into the moment. And the more that you understand the creature you're hunting, not only are you going to be more successful, but you're also going to feel more of that connection, more empathy.
You know, you do focus on deer quite a bit here, which seems like an obvious place to go, because a lot of hunting is for deer. It's hard to believe they ever got low in number. I mean, were they, how far down were the populations?
I have the numbers in the book. I forget, but they were basically the way that bison were run down to near extinction in throughout North America, basically in the U.S. Specifically in the, I think more in the central and eastern U.S., they were run down in the same way, because there was market hunting of deer that was completely unregulated throughout the 19th century. Millions and millions and millions of hides were shipped from various shipping ports. And the meat was used to, their meat was harvested and used to send to camps, to coal mines and stuff. So it's just incredible, but they were almost extinct, which is completely unfathomable now, because there was some conservation laws put in place in the early 20th century, and now deer have obviously rebounded quite robustly in most areas of North America.
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, some of our communities are dealing with deer on city streets on a regular basis and have talked about doing things like potentially having a harvest, but it never got beyond even counting them. And in fact, I think in the city of Ashland, even the second count was just stopped. It had become so controversial. But but deer are out there in big, big numbers for sure. You take us through the deer life cycles in the book and mating season, that sort of thing. And so do the hunting seasons, are they set up to correspond with the mating season?
Well, it depends where you are. In some areas, the seasons vary but basically the ideal hunting season that most hunters fixate on and most hunting regulations open up around is the fall, the rut. That's the annual mating season, where basically deer have a lot less inhibition and a lot less survival instinct. So that's for all the ruminant mammals, so elk and moose and all the deer family, ungulates. And other animals have open seasons at different times. Bears, there's completely different cycles, and waterfowl and the like. But, I mean, ideally hunting in traditional indigenous cultures, it would happen all year long, but there's specific times when certain animals would be targeted because they would have the most fat on them, for instance. Again, that would be the fall. Mm-hmm. And that would be when you could get the most food value out of your kill, because people weren't worried about counting calories or whatever. they were worried about getting enough calories. So So yeah, there's generally the modern hunting regulations do actually correspond quite well to kind of indigenous patterns.
Miles, you take us through many tools of hunting here, including the tools with which to actually kill the animal. Have you worked with bows, crossbows, some of the other tools you list? I mean, there are some people who prefer to do that because they think it's a fairer take on the animal than just a high-powered rifle. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that's definitely a compelling argument, and I believe it for many years. I've made lots of bows. I've shot lots of bows. I haven't hunted anything larger than a grouse with a bow. I've never been able to feel confident to the point that would bring me out for larger animals with a bow. I've hunted with a crossbow. It's kind of my preferred tool because of the silence and elegance and all of that. And as far as high-power rifles, in the past I've had mixed feelings about them, you know, when I was younger, and I've had friends who totally discounted the idea of hunting with a high-powered rifle. But what it really comes down to is, what's going to be the most humane? What's going to cause the animal the least suffering? What are you going to be the most capable with, you know? That's way more important than any kind of intellectual or idealistic idea that one has, you know. It's just efficacy and what's going to be humane and precise. So whatever tool one uses to accomplish that, I think, is a wise one.
Well, there's a lot to think about and a lot to take in the book, The Compassionate Hunter's Guidebook, Hunting from the Heart. Miles Olson wrote it. He's been our guest today on The Exchange. Miles, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You bet. Pleasure to have you. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about documentaries, local Ashland documentaries by Mark and Cece Brown. In our Vents Day segment, Death and Living, we'll talk about the death penalty and where you live and whether you'd like to change that. And apparently in our part of the country, not so much. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the health economist, Dr. Gerald Friedman. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of The Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of JPR, Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.